words. Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what
three little words, which we thought was appropriate on a number of levels when we thought of it as a theme song for Patricia T. O'Connor's visits to our show, because it's about words and what words can do. But it also turns out that at least for the titles of her first three books, she only used three little words. Woe
yes,
is
did.
I. Words fail me, and you send me.
Right, and woe is I, Junior. The fourth word is just Junior, so it doesn't
really
count.
That doesn't count. But I suspect you're going to break that tradition with your next book.
I don't know. The title is still being discussed, and it may be three words, so we'll keep our fingers crossed.
When you come here, we take listener calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. But you usually come by with all sorts of interesting stuff that you've found or that has been inspired by things that our listeners have sent to you. Well, what do you have in store for us today?
Well, Pakistan has been much in the news lately. And did you know that the name Pakistan is an acronym?
No, I didn't. I know what Stan means, because there are a lot of Stans.
Well, Pakistan is a little bit of an exception. It doesn't have Stan because of it means...
It's not like Kurdistan? Afghanistan?
Well, not directly. The way the word was formed, it was formed in 1933 with the partition of India and from East and West Pakistan. And,
well, that was 1948, but with the thinking.
The thinking. The name was formed earlier. And the thinking was that they didn't want to name it for any of the particular provinces or regions, because the idea was to try to get everyone together, no mean feat. And so they chose the P for Punjab, the A for Afghan, the K for Kashmir, and the Istan part comes from the name Baluchistan, which is another of the provinces. So it was formed as an attempt at a neutral name.
And although they also had what is now Bangladesh as part of the country. And maybe that was one of the reasons that that was so problematic. They didn't include it in the name.
They couldn't quite fit a B in there anywhere.
Bangladesh.
No. But the reason that Urdu was chosen as the national language, actually English is the official language of government, but the laws and whatnot are written in the national language, which is Urdu. And the reason that national language was chosen is because they didn't want to choose one of the languages belonging to one of the provinces. So,
or anything that India was using, probably didn't want Hindi.
Correct.
Simply because they wanted to distinguish themselves.
Right. So they wanted to choose a language that wouldn't be singling out one of the provinces. And although not that many people speak Urdu, it's the second or third language of a lot of people in Pakistan. But most of them actually speak Punjabi or Sindhi or Pashto.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was rather interesting,
I think
the way
is.
The name was formed.
And I never knew that. And
right.
I will know it from now on and probably tell it at parties every chance I get.
You know, I wanted to talk about one other thing, because last time I was here, a caller made a mention of, he referred to a home or apartment. And it didn't strike me at the time that that was odd, but an emailer responded, and she said, a recent guest on WNYC kept referring to a home or an apartment. Since when is an apartment not a home? And she says many people use the word as if it were synonymous with house.
Mm-hmm.
And she was found this unsettling. And it's true that the word home, now it has many meanings, from a headquarters to the home page of a website to the place where your cursor hangs out in the upper left-hand corner of your screen. But it typically has meant a dwelling. It started out meaning a village, but it has meant a dwelling for many hundreds of years.
Wait, so it was originally, you'd say, like my hometown.
Exactly. Your home meant your village. And so I responded to her on on our blog, and it started quite a discussion. And one listener, and he's a big fan of yours, by the way, he listens from Paris. His name is Mark. He wrote that he found this house and home discussion interesting, and he did a survey on of Google hits, and he was expecting to find that the word home was used in more snooty references, while house was used in more down-to-earth references.
Like that kind of the old English thing where cow and
beef.
And beef.
Right. But he found just the opposite, interestingly. He found that he got 19 million responses for single-family home, and he got only 2.5 million for single-family house. Hmm. And as he did his research, he found that as the number of bedrooms increased, or the size increased, or the price increased, the place was more likely to be referred to as a house. But the smaller it got, the more humble, the more likely it was to be referred to as a home. And I guess the conclusion is that people with a lot of money aren't hesitant to use a down-to-earth word, and people who are less secure, maybe about their homes or whatever, feel that they have to use a little more abstract or elevated term.
But there's also a song in which the lyric is, "A house is not a home mm-hmm. when there's no one there."
Right. And I think that house is not a home, I think it was a book title. I can't remember whom. I should have checked that out earlier. But I think it was a Poor Little Rich Girl book.
But that's a subtle distinction being made, that a house is not a home. A home meaning something.
Exactly. Where you belong.
Yes.
It's not just the boards and the nails and the bricks and mortar and all.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor. And we are taking your calls here at WNYC, WNYC.org, at 212-433-9692. We have returned to our traditional telephone number. We had a little time after we moved in here where we had a different number, but we're not going to mention it because it confuses me and everyone else. But remember, this is the number we've been using for a long, long time, 433-9692. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. Should we take some calls, or is there another thing you want to talk about?
Let's do take calls.
Okay. Our first caller is Ken from Manhattan. Hi, Ken.
Yeah. Hi. I've been wondering off and on about the tendency to go with Iraq or Iran or, you know, even Kyoto or all sorts of strange things in place of, you know, Iraq, Iran. You know, there's certainly a sociological element to this, or maybe educational or something like that. But also, you know, do the Brits do this? Questions like that. Where does it come from?
Actually, there are a lot of correct pronunciations for Iran. Iran, 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 I believe. But for Iraq, I think there's no long I. An answer for this recently on my blog. So that I...
Well, who would say Iran other than... Oh, I don't know how to say that. I think that most broadcasters would say Iran.
Yes. I'm sure they would.
I think that's the most respectable
right. Iran,
version.
Iran.
Unless you really want to complain about the right. Ayatollah. Then you say, that guy in Iran.
Iran and Iraq are the more common pronunciations. And I don't know about the Brits, but I don't know. You'd have to ask one of them.
Larry from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. What was the Chinese word for Peking before the government changed it to Beijing? And is Peking still the English word for Peking?
Only when we're talking about duck.
I don't know what it was before it was Beijing. I mean, you mean before what the Chinese called it, before it was either Beijing or Peking?
I could be wrong. I thought that in the 1990s, the government changed the name of the city to Beijing from another name. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
Oh, I think what happened was that other countries adopted the pinyin style of spellings, and that actually more closely resembled the word the Chinese used.
Haven't we seen that a lot throughout Asia, for example, especially
right.
where the British were responsible for the pronunciation of a foreign name. Mm-hmm. So you had Sri Lanka was Ceylon, mm-hmm. and obviously mm-hmm. that was probably Sri Lanka before it became
right.
Ceylon.
And Mumbai instead of Bombay.
Although I think that's an invented city in either case. But you also have Kampuchea, which was Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that Beijing just became Peking because it was easier, or somebody misheard it.
Yeah, that was usually the situation. But I think it was the pinyin spellings that were adopted.
Then it also may be in Chinese. Of course, there are so many different dialects. It may be that Peking, and I hope the Chinese speaker is listening and can tell us, Peking may very well have been the name in one of the dialects. For example, Cantonese, it might say it very differently.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese is this odd language where you write it the same, but you pronounce it differently. So even quite differently, like thank you in Cantonese is doche, and in Mandarin it's sheshe, written the same.
But I'm impressed. How do you know this? A Renaissance man.
I did live in Chinatown for a long time.
Wow.
But the same written character will mm-hmm. be pronounced totally differently, to the point where it's almost like the difference between French and English, although you're reading it the same.
Right.
So, but Mandarin was imposed by Mao as the national language, and I suspect that Beijing as the capital came along at that time as well.
Maybe we'll hear from a Chinese listener.
I hope that helps.
Is the harder part of the question was, is Peking still the English word for the city?
No, I think we all say Beijing,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I think that's the word that if somebody wants to be called something,
uh-huh.
well, you make a decision. For example, Myanmar, many people insist on calling it Burma until the military junta, the junta, whatever,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes I say junta and sometimes I say junta. I don't know. Which word do you prefer?
I answered that one once on the blog recently, too. They're both correct.
Okay. Well, then I use them interchangeably. But until the junta is out of office,
mm-hmm.
many people insist on calling it Burma. After that, it will be then decided what you'll call it. We have Congo becoming Zaire, and now it's back
right,
to Congo.
Right. And in some cases, if you call a country something other than what the nationals of that country want it to be called, you're insulting them.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're making you're unconsciously making a political decision that may be inappropriate. So it is something to be aware of.
We have others suddenly more and more occurring to me. Siam is now Thailand.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know whether Thailand land, of course, is not a Thai word, I suspect. But still, uh-huh. that's what...
Right. And we say someone speaks Farsi, not Persian. So there are a lot of examples of this kind of thing.
Should we take another call? Tony. Yeah. Tony from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Going back to the house and home dichotomy, in Britain, people don't refer to their home. They always refer to their house when they're talking about the building.
Mm-hmm.
It's always house. And I don't know if that's just, I don't know what to ascribe it to, but that's just the way they do it.
Except, of course, you may be interested in knowing that the first citation in the OED of the word home used for the building itself was from a 19th century English poet, Felicia Hemans, who wrote, "The stately homes of England, how beautiful they stand amidst their tall ancestral trees o'er all the pleasant land," which was satirized later by Noel Coward in his musical operette as "The stately homes of England, how beautiful they stand to prove the upper classes still have the upper hand."
Of course, there was also the home office in England.
Exactly.
They didn't call it the house office.
Right. But that term stately homes was a British invention.
Right. But I think that the people who actually live in those stately homes refer to their building as the house.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just too pretentious for words.
Right. People in Newport refer to their palaces on the ocean as cottages.
Right.
Thank you for calling us.
Thank you, too.
I think that the house is not a home. The book was really about a brothel. It was about was written by a madam, and we're getting lots of calls from people who want to make that point.
Oh, I meant the one that was recently, though, wasn't it?
That
I was thinking of one that was written in the 20s or 30s.
Well, let's
Maybe
see
I'm
what
wrong.
Jenny Hirschwitz
Maybe I'm
says.
Wrong.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Oh, so nice to be on the air. Thank you so much. I love this program. The book was written by Polly Adler
yes.
in 1953.
Mm.
And it was a sort of self-conscious literary work, partly autobiographical, and an informal social history of immigrant mobility, prostitution, and Jewish life in New York.
Yeah.
And it's well worth the read. It sort of hit the headlines. And then I was born in 1953. I only read it, 10 years later. But it's well worth a reread.
Wait, you read it when you were 10 years old?
Oh, precocious.
Well, I lived on a farm in South Africa, and all I had to entertain me was my mother's wonderful library. So.
And reading about New York brothels. Wow.
It's well worth a reread, and it's an interesting aspect of social life and mobility in New York at the time. I recommend it highly.
Ah.
Well, thank you so much for calling
us. If I run
us.
Across that book, I'm going to grab it.
Well, it was Polly Adler, we should point out, not Pollyanna.
Right.
And my guest is Patricia T. O'Connor. We're taking your calls at 212-433-WNYC. We'll be taking more calls after we take a little break. Stay with us. You may remember that Barack Obama, Joe Biden, and John McCain have all been guests on this show in recent years, and we have posted links to the interviews I did with them. You can go to our show page at WNYC.org to hear them talk about their political and personal lives. And there's a chance that when Senator McCain announces his vice presidential pick on Friday, we'll have had that person on our show as well, and we'll post that one too. And we're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, whose books include Woe Is I, and then the more recent Woe Is I Junior, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and another one in the works, soon to be named, with a cast of thousands. And we are speaking now to Patrick from Manhattan. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hello. As far as Beijing is concerned, it's just North Capital. So Nanjing is South Capital, Beijing North Capital.
Well, somebody points out that there is no J sound in Mandarin. So where does the J come?
Tasha Jing.
It's really more like a Qing.
Well, don't quote me as a total expert on Chinese pronunciation, or Mandarin. But it's just Bei is north, Nan is south, Jing is capital.
So how did Peking come to be named the name of the city?
Well, you have an island called Kiribati, which comes from the word Gilbert. So it's how people do things.
I see. In other words, you're saying it's people just mishearing.
Or using their natively formed ears to make sense of another pronunciation.
Yeah.
But one thing you did touch on was you mentioned sheep in Old English. And in a sense, like Pakistan, has a political connotation because some people call it mutton, some people call it sheep. If you look in Mrs. Beaton's household management book. Mutton would be a Norman formation, and mm-hmm. Sheep would be an Anglo-Saxon thing. And at one time, the way you described your household, you used your household terms was how you had aligned yourself politically with the Normans or mm-hmm. Anglo-Saxons.
So if you wanted to be seen as connected to the norm, as you sang, I got plenty of mutton, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's right.
By the way, in the Southwest, there are all these places with names like Tsegi Canyon, and there's a Canyon de Chelly, and a whole bunch of other things that sound similar. And a Navajo told me that the word for canyon is Tsegi. So when outsiders came in and said, what do you call that? They said, Tsegi. So, of course, Westerners always assume that there's a name to everything, not just you just call it canyon. So they call it Tsegi Canyon. The Spanish translated that into Chelly, Chelly, or something like that, which became Canyon de Chelly. But it's all the same word, again, distorted.
Oh, that's interesting.
Throughout the Navajo territory. And I think that probably the same thing, that process occurred all over the world.
Yeah, I'm sure it did.
Should we take some more calls?
Yeah.
Okay. David from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Leonard. Thanks for taking my call. Two things. The first one about the Iran thing. I believe I've often heard it. Politicians use it pejoratively when they want to talk down to foreign governments or foreign ideas, like Bushisms, you know, Iran type of thing. I think it's used that way sometimes by politicians.
Yeah, well, you're probably right. I think we have a call from somebody who may actually know, may speak the language. Hi, your name is Humayun?
Yes, it's Humayun. I'm an Iranian-American. I've lived in the States for about 30 years. I live in Yorktown Heights, and I'm calling about the words Iran, Iraq, and also the use of Farsi versus Persian in English, which all of them were touched upon. The word Iran, the first use of it, as far as I know, is about 1,000 years ago, and it was Ariana, which was in Middle Persian. And in modern Persian, the pronunciation is Iran. You could divert to the older pronunciation and go to Iran, but anything other than that is really not, I don't think it's proper. And in fact, it bothers most Iranians to hear Iran.
I want to ask you about that Ariana. Isn't that the same word as Aryan, the word that was used by the Nazis, because it's an Indo-European word meaning something like brother or relative?
Actually, it means noble. Arya means nobleman. So Ariana means the land of the noble people. Now, Hitler used that for his advantage, but it really Iran means the land of the Aryans, but not in the Nazi connotation. This name has been there for over 1,000 years, and it means the land of the noble people, who are the Aryans who came from the Black Sea and went south into the Iranian plateau and then later on into northern India. And then some of them came into Europe. So then Hitler sort of misuse that or use it to his advantage. It has nothing to do with any, it's not really derogatory.
He gave Aryan a bad name.
Yes, exactly. And the other word is Iraq. A lot of people I've noticed in the invasion had no idea what the word Iraq means, and I give them the right because what happens is that it's really a Persian word, and Iraq at the old days when it was a province of Iran, of the old Iran, there were two provinces, one called Iran-e-Ajam, and the other one, I'm sorry, Iraq-e-Ajam, the other one was Iraq-e-Arab. The first one means the Persian-speaking Iraq, the other one means the Arab-speaking Iraq. Now, the country Iraq is the Arab-speaking Iraq province. So the original word was Arag, actually, with a G, and it means the two rivers. And you can understand
the Tigris
why.
And the Euphrates. Obviously.
Exactly. So, what happened is the Arabs don't have the sound G. So, the Arabized version became Araq, which they changed the G to G, which became Araq. And then in English, since the G doesn't exist, it became Iraq. So, Araq or Iraq would be the proper pronunciation, I think, for that country. Mm.
Thank
the other
you.
Word is, if I may, the word Farsi, If you look at the definition in the British dictionaries, including Oxford, it says that it is a derogatory name, really. It's a Farsi is a Persian word for the language Farsi, and it's sort of like referring to the Japanese language as Nihongo in the English language. When you use it in English, it should really be Persian, because that there's no word called Farsi in the English language. It's the Persian word for the word Persian.
Yeah.
So all this time when I said Farsi, thinking I was doing the right thing, I was doing the wrong thing.
It's only been used since the revolution. Prior to that, if you look up the fourth definition in Oxford Dictionary, they say that it's not too late to get rid of this vulgar term. So just look it up for yourself.
Thank you so much for calling us. That's just fabulous.
That was really helpful.
We learned an awful lot from our audience.
Well, you have the greatest audience in the world. You have the most erudite, intelligent audience.
I'd like to believe that.
It's true.
My guest is Patricia Teal. Well, you get all these emails from them telling you all sorts of things about the language. Some of the things are sent to me first, and I pass them on to you, and I'm stunned by the erudition. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor. We're talking about the English language, as we do once a month, every month, and it's always a lot of fun. And Jeremy from Manhattan calling on a car phone. I hope that you've pulled over to the side or are using some kind of a hands-free.
Yes, I did. I did. First of all, by the way, the old national airline of Afghanistan was Ariana Airlines. And I guess it related to some sense of nobility. But my question has to do with a class of adjectives which end in L-Y. Mm-hmm. There are a whole bunch of them, curmudgeonly, gingerly, so forth.
And I friendly? Just
wondered, yes, and I wondered, I wondered how that worked.
Considering the fact that we were always told in school that adverbs ended with L-Y and not adjectives.
Right.
We were brainwashed.
There's a special case in gingerly because ginger, you know, if you think about the base word ginger, it's always unclear how gingerly relates to what ginger has to do with the action that's being talked about.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people think that anything with an L-Y ending must properly be an adverb, and that if you use an adverb, you ought to at least add an L-Y to it. For instance, quickly. You can't say run quick, you must say run quickly. I should explain that there's a class of words that exist as, they're both adjective and adverb, and they're called flat adverbs.
Sure.
And they don't necessarily take an L-Y. And one of them is slow. I know people don't like to hear this, but there's nothing wrong with saying walk slow, drive slow. It's only fairly recently, in the last couple of hundred years, that grammarians have decided that there should be more of a distinct difference between adjectives and adverbs, and that we should add ly to these words. Some of them, in fact, are adjectives that already have ly. That's why when you look in the dictionary, you find abominations, I think, like friendlily, jollily.
Right.
But how else, what would you say instead of jollily?
Well, I think you just say, you'd probably rephrase it. But, you know, in Texas.
But merrily is okay?
Right, merrily is all right. But I'm not saying that adverbs don't take ly. There are some that do. But there are some words that don't have to have an ly added to be proper adverbs.
And in other words, the English language is inconsistent. Is that what you're saying?
And what was the caller's original question? I may have.
It was about adjectives like gingerly, curmudgeonly, etc.
Right. Curmudgeonly is a perfectly good adjective, and you can say he did something in a curmudgeonly manner, but I think to say curmudgeonly is
well, people do tend to
going
add,
too far.
We have preventative and things like that. People do tend to add syllables But,
right.
But that one would be very uncomfortable.
Right, right.
But how about the concept of gingerly?
Well, I think of gingerly as an adjective. He
but
did something in a gingerly way. The way was gingerly.
Yeah, but
not he
relate-
spoke gingerly.
Right. Where does the ginger come from? Ginger? Is this the ginger, the what do we call it?
It's
a spice
from the
vegetable?
Spice, yeah.
Well, why would we walk gingerly? Because the spice just doesn't make us, it doesn't bring that to mind.
Yeah, I don't know. Some of these things are beyond me. I have to bow to higher authorities.
Maybe somebody named Ginger can call and explain.
But I think to speak gingerly, I guess there's nothing wrong with that, but I certainly wouldn't add another L-Y, gingerly.
No.
But way. There have been grammarians who've suggested that we should say jollily and livelily and friendlily.
Well, there were grammarians who complained about split infinitives.
Are there
still grammarians who worry about that sort of thing?
Well, grammarians know better than that now, but there are still people who cling to that old belief, even though it's never really been a legitimate grammatical rule. It's been misguided usage people for the most part.
Don from West New York, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm bothered by the expression, heard a lot of at the time of Tim Russert's death, but still heard, to whom much is given, much is expected. Sounds at the very least like a bad translation. What is that to doing there? Shouldn't it be from?
Yeah. People were saying to whom, oh, I see. To whom much is given, oh, I see, should be from, no, wait a minute.
No, but I think it's to those whom much has been given is what's really implied there.
To whom much has been given.
Much is expected.
Well, where's the from, then?
Where's the from? Yeah, it's a from that expression requires, not a to.
From whom much is given. But you don't give something from someone. From those
to
whom.
From.
I think you'd say from those to whom much has
That's
been
right.
given, much is
That's
expected.
Right. That's right. And I wonder, what is the origin of that whole thing? I mean, is it indeed translated from something and badly translated? Because it surely doesn't work.
It's probably from either the Bible or Shakespeare, since most things are from either the Bible or Shakespeare. I don't know which.
Thank you for calling us.
Okay.
And if Shakespeare's listening, could you call in? And
let us know. Clear that up.
I'm not going to ask for the other author. Enrique from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Helena. Thanks for having me. I was just trying to figure out why you said junta to a Spanish word that should be used that way originally, junta. It's not even a Spanish correct word for the use. It's a derogatory term for a group of military people or from different forces, maybe.
And we use it derogatorily as well in English, don't we?
That's right. I don't think the group of military refer themselves as a junta.
Of course not. They refer to them as the supreme leaders.
That's right. So since there is no word in English like that, I don't think junta or something like that is to be used. I think it should be the original, which is junta.
Well, then we should say Madrid, right?
Well, actually, that word
Mexico.
Now is it has been adopted into English, junta. And it actually wasn't pejorative originally. It just meant a council or a legislative body. And later on, it became.
We've run out of time, Pat, but people can write to you at mailbox@gramophobia.com.
Right.
And I look forward to seeing you next month. It's always a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, live from Denver, more coverage from the Democratic Convention. We'll take the temperature of the Democratic Party and where it seems to be heading. Also, a look at what Senator Obama could learn from Colorado's Governor Bill Ritter. Charlton Heston's daughter, Holly Heston, talks about her dad's work on the silver screen and what it was like growing up with a film star for a father, plus our latest underreported. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Julia Cochran, Barbara Kahn, and Lawrence Holland. A special thanks to Lawrence for all his work this summer producing our underappreciated literature series. He's going back to Harvard. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.